The Tom Woods Show, episode 2365.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. As the academic year winds down, it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do in the fall. And of course, I highly recommend the self-taught K through 12 Ron Paul curriculum. Not only will your kids get the real story about everything, but they'll also learn the kinds of practical things that they won't learn in the traditional school. For instance, how to be an effective public speaker, how to manage money, and how to run your own home business. And of course, when they reach the high school grades, they will be learning Western civilization and U.S. government from old Tom Woods here. But here's the most important thing. If you're going to join, make sure you join through my link, because only through my link do you get $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Look, I got to get some stuff off my chest here. But really, I also want to hear the thoughts of somebody who really does follow this stuff pretty closely. And the stuff I'm talking about is the GOP primary right now. And the main two people in it, in terms of the poll numbers, obviously are Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. But it's just been interesting to me to watch what's happened on Twitter. And I think, oh gosh, Twitter is not real life. I don't know. I mean, you're probably right, but it's probably not a million miles removed from real life either. Something's going on here where I feel like 6 months ago, I think most people who are liable to vote for either Trump or DeSantis would have said, they're both pretty decent guys in one way or another. And now so many think one is the devil or terrible or whatever. It's just incredible what's happened. Anyway, so I have with me today Tho Bishop of the Mises Institute, who is a pretty good observer of these sorts of things. And you have a connection with your local GOP, is that right?
Yes. I'm chairman these days, which is an interesting hat to wear, but it's always good to be able to drop some Rothbard quotes from time to time. So that's how I use it.
All right. Well, good for you. Good for you. And again, I ask you this every time because I have the addled brain of a man of my age, but your official title once again over at Mises?
I'm a content director these days at the Institute. We're putting up a whole lot of stuff, a lot of podcasts, a lot of animated videos, and numbers keep going up.
Nice. Well, good for you. Good for you. All right. So first of all, I know for a long time that you were cheering the kinds of things, maybe not everything, but a good number of the things that Ron DeSantis was doing in Florida. And you were a big supporter of his and saying that this is a much, much better direction for the GOP than the usual strategy of lie down and die. But I wonder, has that changed at all for you? Or are you in the DeSantis camp when it comes to the presidency or what?
Well, there is, I think, an interesting distinction where DeSantis' leadership at the state level, I still think, is the best model out there in terms of achieving significant wins in the policy arena. I think what he's been doing in terms of bolstering state sovereignty against the biomedical security state, against the state-run universities, going out against central bank digital currencies and the like, I think that model is the most interesting thing that has happened in conservative politics, if we accept that label, in a very long time. And there's nothing that this campaign does that can shake what I see or results from that level. It is interesting, though, watching this kind of scale nationally. For one, there's a whole other set of questions that come with national policy, Ron DeSantis on foreign policy, and I think that's actually a major issue for a reason I'll get to later. But ultimately, though, if you're going to enter this arena, if you're going to take on the king, where Trump as a figure has such a unique pull towards the loyalty of the base, and we could sit here on the side and say, well, how can anyone be loyal to Trump after COVID, after all this spending, after appointing a whole bunch of swamp hacks into it? All these are valid criticisms. But to that rank and file conservative base voter, we're seeing that Trump still has 50%+ of that loyalty, which has only been strengthened as a result of the various indictments against Trump and all these various attempts that people see as trying to take down their icon. So DeSantis enters this environment where we all know it's going to be a very difficult campaign. And you see the way that he is navigating this arena. And it's leaves someone like me who, again, is can make a policy case for DeSantis trying to figure out what is he doing? Because it's kind of interesting. A lot of the energy that I would have thought DeSantis could have tapped into, particularly the way that the COVID issue has awakened people on various corruptive aspects of that entity. A lot of that's being drifted over to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And you can see in the contrast those campaigns, DeSantis is running a very tightly controlled campaign, not a lot of questions, not a lot of long form interviews outside of sort of very loyalist audiences. Whereas R.F. Kennedy Jr. is out there willing to go on Dave Smith's show, willing to go on Joe Rogan, talk to Ron Paul audiences the like. And so I think that DeSantis's own, I think there might be an element where they are trying to overcompensate for DeSantis not having the charisma and the personality. But in doing so, his campaign seems like a status quo campaign aesthetically. Looks like some mix of Scott Walker or even a little bit, I think, of some of the troubles that Rand Paul had trying to placate the establishment while still trying to keep his father's sort of base. And it's kind of creating a dynamic where you're not seeing people rush to this exciting new thing, but rather kind of appreciate the unique theater that you get with the Trump show.
Okay, that's kind of what I've been thinking. You're right about, as you call it, the aesthetic of the campaign. I mean, this is a guy who is not a Scott Walker. I mean, he legitimately has gone places that the GOP would not normally go. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for a lot of things. But he's, I don't know. I mean, I am uncomfortable with some of the people who want to support him, but I don't blame him for that. I mean, John Wayne Gacy supported Jimmy Carter, but that doesn't mean that Jimmy Carter favors eating people. I never really go for that kind of that thing, but it gives me a little bit of pause that he is still a bit unknown to me and that I don't know entirely where he would go on foreign policy, but that I absolutely would trust RFK Jr. over him. I would, because I think he's more of a known quantity. He's given direct answers to questions like this at length. And as you say, he will give extended long form interviews because I think he has a really, really significant knowledge base. And yet during COVID, what impressed me was that DeSantis had a very impressive knowledge base. There are people who think he's not that bright. He was citing papers off the top of his head that he had obviously read, and he could hold his own in a room with top scientists. He very, very much impressed me. Let me put it this way. DeSantis right now is being subjected to attacks from the Trump people, among them the claim that he was just another lockdown governor. Now, it's true. He did lock down, and he locked down for longer than he should have, and I complained about it at the time. I wasn't just giving him a free pass. I have the newsletters to prove it, though. I have them. And in which I couldn't believe I had to drive to Georgia to go out for dinner. Like, this is not right. So I completely understand the irritation with him at the very beginning. And he should never have done that. We all agree. I think he agrees with that. But this is a guy who he appointed by far the best Surgeon General in the country, Joseph Latipo. I mean, it's not even a contest. Latipo is the kind of guy who says, you know, you want to stay healthy. How about getting some sunshine and some exercise and watching your diet? How about that? Instead of sitting on the couch with a bag of pretzels with five needles sticking out of your arm, you know, to prove that you're up to date on your shots or whatever. I mean, this guy has been absolutely fantastic. And then again, I can list the fact that DeSantis elevated Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff and some of these other dissident scientists, including Robert Malone and others, Peter McCullough at various roundtables. Even Trump didn't do that. I mean, yeah, Bhattacharya did meet with Trump. That's true. I don't know if I think he said that on my show, so I guess I'm allowed to say that. But if I had been Trump, sorry to talk so much here, though, but if I'd been Trump, I would have had these roundtables on national blankety-blank television. Now, of course, I can't compel the networks to cover it, but I would have held these roundtables. Somebody's got to cover it, even if it's C-SPAN, even if it's podcast networks, whatever. I would have had these every single week with scientists refuting all the BS from the crazies. And in effect, that's what DeSantis was doing. And now they're going around saying, oh, he was locked down or DeSantis, when meanwhile, their own guy was saying that Sweden was going to be a bloodbath if they didn't lock down. And Brian Kemp in Georgia opened up too early, and that was a big mistake. Can't we say both of these are human beings with obvious flaws and some virtues? What is so hard about that?
Well, the Trump campaign has done a great job doing everything they can to cast DeSantis as a Manchurian candidate, right? And so, oh, well, DeSantis really is, you know, he's the chosen candidate of the Murdochs and the Bushes and Paul Ryan and, you know, all these villainous characters. I mean, you have George Soros and the like. And so they've done a good job of just spouting this nonstop on platforms that their base, particularly the most active of their base, consume on a near daily basis. Steve Bannon's war room being very influential in terms of informing that certain type of electorate. And so what you have is a dynamic where people are hearing this, and in some way, right, they're responding to narratives about distrusting the reptile people that we would largely agree with, right? Like anyone who has the support of these sort of shady folks, we would naturally be skeptical of, no matter the nice things they say on a campaign trail. And in doing so, they're trying to completely rewrite the record. And it's effective. It's effective. Now, I do think that it's very difficult to convince even the most diehard Trump supporter that Florida was worse than New York as Trump continues to spout. I don't think they quite follow him on that. They can say, oh, it's Trump being Trump. But they've done a great job of boxing that, where people that have respect and appreciation, who were big DeSantis people just 8 months ago, now are convinced that he is someone that can't be trusted. Now, the irony of all this is that Kevin McCarthy is someone that Trump still brings into the Oval Office on a regular basis. Paul Ryan was made Speaker of the House after Trump's endorsement in 2016. Karl Rove, he handed over his 2020 campaign to. His campaign manager supported Ronna Romney as RNC chair in some of the inter-party battles, right? And so the thing is, though, is that all this record, it doesn't matter to people that have this emotional connection there and view Trump as a victim in all this and have this underlying suspicion of anyone who looks like a politician. I think DeSantis' biggest failure, though, and it goes back to the foreign policy issue, is that he is someone whose entire argument for the campaign is one of merit and intelligence. And so we've talked about him not really having a campaign that's showing it off the same way that Robert F. Kennedy can talk about what he's really passionate about. The other side of it, though, is that he's lost the endorsement or support of one very important person. And I fought this, I think this is a direct failure of DeSantis individually rather than overly controlling campaign teams. And that's Tucker Carlson. We've now had multiple times now in the recent weeks. First was one of Tucker's videos on Twitter. The other one was a clip I saw from his recent interview with Russell Brand, where Tucker is talking about this foreign policy issue, something we obviously care a great deal about. And it's very clear that Tucker Carlson believes, or at least is telling people that he believes, and I don't think he's a disingenuous guy on this issue, that he thinks that Trump is the only guy on the Republican side. You know, I don't know if he considers Vivek Ramaswamy as a real candidate or not, but he clearly does not think that DeSantis is dependable on the foreign policy issue. He hasn't said that explicitly, saying all that war hawk DeSantis, but it's clear with the way that he talks about Trump within this field that he sees DeSantis as part of the problem and not part of the solution. And I think back to where Tucker was praising DeSantis for a statement that he gave the Tucker Carlson show back when it was still on Fox about seeing no value in engaging in a proxy war between Russia and Ukraine, and that's an American interest. And then just a few days later, again, I think he got pushback from some of the donor class out there where he softens up that language. Now, he hasn't gone explicitly saying, oh, we need to be sending cluster bombs to Ukraine or anything like that. But there's been a clear attempt to sort of dance around some of these issues that donors, for whatever reason, are very motivated by. And I think that is a major red flag to someone like Tucker. And so the fact that, you know, when you read the text messages that Tucker had that came out in the Fox News Dominion lawsuit, where, you know, he's saying, let's say, not nice things about Donald Trump, when you have reports out there that he was telling staffers that he voted for Kanye West, Tucker is someone who I think got tired of the larger Trump circus, someone who has a very clear agenda. Don't always agree with it. He takes way too many pot shots at Austrians. I think he is convinced of some sort of clever pot shot at the Koch brothers, which whatever. But he's someone who clearly has an agenda and clearly motivated on the foreign policy issue, where DeSantis has lost any, I think, attempt to win that support. And I think losing some of those figures that have that elevated sense of relevance from the conservative sphere, when we're dealing with a post-Rush Limbaugh world and the way that his show was a major, major force, when Fox News has the communicators out there that have enough broad appeal that DeSantis could rely upon them as being sort of secondhand messengers of his campaign. And if he lost Tucker Carlson, that is his own self-inflicted wound. And again, it feeds to, again, this larger skepticism that voters have about the sincerity of DeSantis, how much of his Florida stuff is performance art opportunism, rather than a sincere commitment to principle. Now, I don't share that cynical view of DeSantis. I know Daniel McCarthy, our friend, has been in conversations with DeSantis, or, you know, kind of closed door meetings with DeSantis, where he talks about his foreign policy views, and he has identified him as a realist, not a neocon. I take that sort of analysis seriously, but I'm not surprised that people are kind of seeing him more as an opportunistic candidate when he runs the campaign than we would expect from an opportunistic candidate.
My suspicion is that he's trying to win, wants to win as many Republicans as he can, and he knows there are a lot of people who think a certain way on foreign policy, and that Trump is going to win a huge number of the people who have a particular opinion on Ukraine. So he maybe wants to somehow straddle that particular fence, which I think is a difficult task to undertake. I mean, I think that's what's going on, because when I hear RFK talk about this, he's so blunt and straightforward. He already knows he's not going to win the interventionists. He already knows he's not going to get that vote. So why bother pandering to it? Why be ambiguous, or why leave the door open, or why at least appear to be winking at people? Why not just say what he believes? I think it was that plain spokenness from DeSantis at press conferences and stuff that initially drew people to him. But now that he's in presidential campaign mode, or once he started to shift into that, I think you did start to get this kind of DeSantis that understandably makes people sort of concerned. Now, at the same time, I want to read you something that our friend Steve Dace from The Blaze, I've known him since he was an Iowa radio host, wrote on Twitter the other day. And it's that maybe you've seen it. He said this: time for the adults to have a talk. Mid-March was when reports of a looming Trump indictment in Manhattan began to percolate heavily. On March 12th, Trump was at his lowest in the RCP national primary polling average. Over the next 118 days, Trump rose a massive 10 points in that same polling average. So what changed? Have Trump's favorables demonstrably improved? No, he's still a collective minus 16, according to 538's average. Is Trump crushing DeSantis in fundraising? No, as we just saw this week. So what changed? What calculus was added to the metric to ascend Trump's numbers when no other metric indicates such dominance? There's only one thing. Trump was indicted not once but twice on complete and obvious partisan persecutions during this time. There is no other option. DeSantis's favorables among Republicans are still very high. So if it primarily was Ron's fault, his favorables among the primary electorate would have suffered accordingly. People don't sour on a campaign without souring also on its candidate. And Republicans still really like DeSantis. Effectively, Democrat lawfare is behaving as a de facto Trump super PAC. Republicans are rightfully rallying to a past champion who is obviously being unfairly persecuted for being their past champion. I understand this inclination, and I've said all along that I have no problem with Trump running on "I shall return MacArthur-like retribution." I like that chip on the shoulder if it is harnessed properly. However, the Democrat lawfare isn't going to stop, and Republican voters probably aren't going to realize on their own they are being lured into a little bighorn ambush by the Democrats. Yes, by all means, rally to your champion, Democrats are saying. We want you to nominate him. In fact, we're actively encouraging it and are publicly enabling it. We look forward to running against a convicted felon that 48% of Americans have proven the last four elections in a row they don't want any part of what he's a part of. For now, we're being afforded the luxury of rallying to a candidate most of us know cannot win a general election. But there will come a time when time is up, when we will be stuck with a weakened proxy who is struggling to stay out of prison, raise money, retain and recruit credible and effective staff, and doesn't even seem to be trying to rehabilitate his image to reach suburban voters we must have to win a must-win election. And make no mistake, 2024 is a must-win election. I cannot even imagine how much more evil will be unleashed if we don't, not to mention Trump likely spends the rest of his natural life incarcerated. For the adults, non-grifters, non-cultists, critical thinkers, people who care more about their kids and grandkids than any politician, etc., there are two options. One, Trump must have a strategy to run on our behalf as likely a convicted felon beyond grainy chitlib type videos over at Truth Social with increasingly lame taunts, which is most of his current strategy. That ain't winning Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Pennsylvania, etc. And we might be picking out our plots at the gulag soon after 2024 if we don't win at least some of those. Trump will be wearing an ankle bracelet at his posh resort if he loses. We'll be trying to stop them from castrating our kids to flat out euthanizing them. Number two, DeSantis' central campaign message perhaps becomes what Casey launched this week. Run a parallel primary campaign to Trump that goes after suburban voters who both will be attracted by that message, but also aren't zealously loyal to Trump. Don't even bother competing for voters who would gladly follow Trump off a cliff with their whole families just to prove some point that won't make nearly the difference winning would. Those same suburban voters are also more likely to be receptive to the reality of the difficulties of nominating Trump and plain talk where that is concerned. Get on the national stage as often as you can, with or without Trump. The next election is more than just win or go home. It's win, or don't be so sure you'll even have a home to go home to. That's Steve Dace. What do you think about that?
I think his analysis is spot on. I would like to see DeSantis' campaign embrace that. I think it's necessary for them to do so if they're going to have any shot of changing the tide here. And then there's plenty of time, you know, so I think trying to rule a campaign over this far out, particularly as well-funded as it is, would be foolish. That's going to require a pivot from the campaign itself. And I think something that DeSantis could very easily do, and he's had opportunities in the past and he's not done it, is that he should replicate the Trump strategy of 2016, where he goes out there and names names and starts attacking the Republicans that embody the party that most of the Republican base does not want. So going out there and calling out Kevin McCarthy for the debt ceiling deal and continuing to wear Ukraine pins, going after Paul Ryan for his record of complete failure as he starts taking pot shots. I think the debate stage is a very interesting opportunity for him to really hammer after Nikki Haley. And I think if he can start projecting that sort of bully ball tactics that made Trump such an entertaining figure. Now, again, his personality obviously is not Trump, but I think that he has to be aggressive running against the Republican Party of old if he is going to have any shot of trying to create that secondary pathway for those that are Trump voters, not necessarily the diehard loyalists, but the people that were inspired by Trump, but are concerned about the long-term consequences of a Trump nomination, both the viability in the general, particularly in certain key states like Georgia, Arizona, and the like, and then also the downroad consequences to what it means to the House and the Senate. And so far, I have not seen that articulated outwards from the DeSantis campaign in a cohesive fashion. And I also think, going back to the foreign policy issue, is that while I can understand not wanting to alienate certain voters that might have foreign policy views different than our own, those voters are largely overrepresented within the donor class, not the voter class. And I think that's one of the mistakes that DeSantis has made, is that with a focus on fundraising numbers, and don't get me wrong, I understand money is the lifeblood of a campaign. I'm not saying that he should be running a low budget campaign by any means, but ultimately his biggest value to the donor class, who always had problems with the way that he approached certain issues in Florida, didn't like the way he dealt with Disney, yada, yada, they were going to fall behind him only because of his perceived strength against Trump being the only viable alternative, if his messaging would reflect a voter forward dynamic rather than a donor base forward dynamic. I don't know if he's concerned about Tim Scott taking up some of that money or whatever, but Tim Scott's going to be irrelevant in a few months either. I don't think anyone in my local rec ever mentions his presidential campaign that I don't even see in Twitter conversations. That, I think, is a strategic miscalculation that DeSantis has made. I think ultimately something like what Steve is outlining there is necessary for a pivot, but we need to see that pivot, and it has not come up yet.
Do you think Trump would actually participate in a debate given his commanding lead? And if he doesn't, then doesn't the debate just look like a bunch of losers?
I don't expect Trump to debate, at least I think they've already said they're looking at avoiding the first two. After that, it doesn't matter. You'll still get some interest, some, you know, that it's one of the few live television events that people still watch. And so the question then is, what can DeSantis do to extract some value without Trump in the room? And the problem is that going after Trump directly is difficult to do because you risk people doubling down on some of the concerns out there with him. So I think kind of putting his fire to the others is the safest approach there. But again, it's a very difficult problem. And it's a problem that we all knew was going to be there. And again, they have not identified any sort of novel strategy to approach that very particular problem that was unavoidable in this election. The one good thing to take out of this, though, is that if you look at the polling, the top three candidates in most polls are the least old school Republican type of politician in Trump, DeSantis, and Vivek Ramaswamy. Now, again, I understand that's not an endorsement of Trump's 4 years in office, but he is still the least like the Bush years of the Republican Party relative to the other ones out there. People like Mike Pence, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, they're all polling in the very low single digits. Chris Christie is out there only as a New Jersey foil for Trump. So we see at the very least, the base is not looking to retreat back to the evils of Bush-era Republican politics. They are looking for something different. But again, the question of whether Trump is a viable candidate, that is a problem that I think both the DeSantis camp right now does themselves some disservice by kind of suggesting that polls don't matter at this point. Polls are measuring something, but also the unwillingness to look at the underlying unfavorables and kind of banking on the weakness of Biden, who may not be the nominee, particularly with all the negative media headlines out there. It seems to me there's some sort of pivot in the way that the corporate press's narrative is changing in terms of the president. Ignoring that issue should be a major concern. I don't know what, theoretically, if Trump really does just sail through the nomination, and if you're concerned about another 4 years of a Democratic administration, which I am a lot more than I would have been in the past, seeing the way that the Biden administration has been able to wield the federal power the last few years, has made me think, okay, well, maybe there is something to be said there about at least having a break at the federal level while the more interesting state-level dynamics continue to percolate and kind of strengthening up some of the resistance to the federal regime. What can Trump even do at this point to appeal to those that obviously did not come out either in 2020 or 2022 with all of the pressures from inflation and the like? And it's a very frustrating political problem for those who allow their mental health to be dictated by it. I mean, at this point, it's like the best outcome that you could have with a Trump nomination is some sort of Trump-Kennedy ticket to try to really kind of double down on that anti-establishment aesthetic and see what you can do there. But it's a very, as someone who would like to see what some of the more interesting aspects of DeSantis-style leadership in Florida could possibly look like in the federal level, it is frustrating to see just the extent to which that emotional loyalty, which again, I fully understand because of who I talk to here in my community, having that oversee something more substantive in terms of the outcomes of the election.
Well, given that you are chairman of a local branch of the party, is it appropriate or inappropriate for you to openly endorse a particular candidate during the primary?
I don't endorse within it. And again, I can make a case before the midterm elections. I was fully in favor of 4 years of Trump just doing everything he can to do it a revenge tour, and then 8 years of kind of a build-up sort of dynamic like that. That was my state of personal preference. I know all the problems of Donald Trump. I've made plenty of critiques of his administration. It was inadequate in many ways from the promises of 2016, but I was someone who I thought the 2016 election was a very positive spin. And so I can be sold on that going forward. So I'm out of it. I've made it clear, though, if we nominate Nikki Haley, I'm going to resign my position and start campaigning for a third party RF Kennedy ticket or something like that. But when it comes to Trump or DeSantis, I think both of them reflect a positive development in terms of how Republicans are thinking relative to the past. But it is frustrating just the quality of the discourse. And this is coming from both sides in terms of the Twitter space. The quality of the discourse right now, I think, is completely inadequate to the very serious issues that we have. And so trying to navigate that and not losing my temper when some of the criticism comes out there is not always the easiest thing to do, but that's why they pay me the big bucks.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. All right, so I guess Twitter is a good place to follow you, at Tho Bishop, so T-H-O and then the word Bishop, and then the Mises Institute, because of course you are behind the scenes making content happen for us over there, so Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and I follow you on Twitter. I probably should put you on my list. I have a list, secret list of people I follow whose content is consistently good. It's not just dumb sniping at people, but really good content. You should be on that list. So I'm going to do that after we finish this conversation today. But thanks for your input on this. I just wanted to get off my chest. I just can't get over that we're in the situation where people who seemed to be friends less than a year ago are now thinking that they're mortal enemies of each other. It's unbelievable what politics can do to people.
It is a reminder of the very toxic aspect of political action. And so after the fun of the last few years, particularly as a Florida man, it's probably necessary to have that reminder. And for anyone out there in your audience that is interested in conversations that avoid the toxicity of the political dynamic, we've got a Medical Freedom Summit in New Hampshire in August, on August 19th with Dr. Peter McCullough and other great speakers that I will be at. And in Nashville, Tennessee, we're doing an event against our limitless regime with Dr. Michael Wechterwald, Ted Carpenter, and a few others. And I'll be there as well on September 23rd. And so if you want a political toxicity-free environment. Those are two Mises events that we have coming up.
All right, excellent to know. So check them out at the events page at mises.org. Thanks a lot, though. Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.